or lease from...
The royalty of college football is in assembly.
Oh, my gracious, him. How about that?
We just stepped on their face with a hot nail thinking off their nose.
Welcome to the College Football Country Podcast. My name is Josh Parcell, founder of College Football Country, CFBCountry.com. And today, my guest, Yogi Roth from the Pac-12 Network, also a former assistant coach at USC. He now also hosts the Season of Sam podcast with Sam Darnold, quarterback at USC. Give it a download. Check it out. It's another great podcast for you to add to your arsenal, especially if you're a college football fan or especially a USC fan as well. Hope you guys enjoy this episode. Before I get to Yogi, I just want to remind everybody, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Download it. Share it with your friends. Tell everybody on Facebook, on Twitter, anybody you see at the gym, at the bar, whoever it is, let them know about this show. It's getting bigger and better every week. Hope you listened to Take the Points last week with Chris Felica. We gave out a bunch of winners on that show, went 5-1 against the spread in week 2. We are now 10-3 this season, so you're going to want to listen this week. Week 3 of Take the Points coming out on Friday as well. Before we get to Yogi, I want to touch on one subject, my opening topic of the day, something everybody's been talking about since Saturday's games, and that's Baker Mayfield. And after the game against Ohio State on Saturday night, Oklahoma with the big win over the Buckeyes in Columbus, Baker goes to midfield, takes the Oklahoma flag, plants it on the 50-yard line, and everybody erupts. Everybody has an opinion. It becomes the most controversial moment in college football that week, and it takes away from the 31-16 win that was maybe the most impressive win Oklahoma has had in 3 or 4 seasons. And then Baker comes out on Monday and probably by the request of his coach, Lincoln Riley, apologizes for that comment. Here it is.
It was an emotional game. I told you guys that last week that it was. I knew that it was going to have a lot of implications on the playoffs, and so that's the way we were prepared. And so it was an emotional game. And so after the game, it did not mean for it to be disrespectful towards any Ohio State people at all, especially not the team or the players, because they're a great team and a great program. So I didn't mean it to be disrespectful at all. I mean, we do the flag thing at OU Texas, and so that's just something that I got caught up in, an emotional win. And, you know, yeah, it should have been something I did in the locker room, so I apologize for doing it in the middle of the field.
So the immediate reaction afterwards from most of the members of the media, most of Twitter, was, why is he apologizing for this? He was just having fun. This is what makes college football great. Baker should never have to apologize for this. It was fun. It was harmless. Let Baker live. Stop ruining fun. Stop being like the NFL. And in a lot of cases, I agree. I have always said, let football be fun. Do not take away the spirit of the game, the emotion of the game. Let these kids enjoy themselves, bask in the glory of victories. And in this case, I'm going to go against the grain. I'm going to say something that I don't think is very popular. And I think as a fan of college football in general, this was great. It was entertaining. It was different. It was emotional. Maybe you grew an attachment to Baker that you didn't have before. But as an Oklahoma fan or as an Oklahoma coach, yeah, this does concern me a little bit, because I think there's a difference, whether it's a quarterback or whether it's anybody on the field, at celebrating, having emotion, but also having respect in class. And I don't want to sound like the old guy who's telling everybody to get off my lawn, but I do think that taking your flag and being so demonstrative and so, I guess, calling attention to yourself like what Baker did, I don't think that that was necessary. And it could have been very easy to run the flag around the field, wave it in front of your fans, the fans who travel to Columbus for the game. There's other ways to celebrate without showing up an opponent. And as great as Baker Mayfield is as a player, and as great as he was on Saturday night, let's just face it. That's something that the best leaders and the best quarterbacks that we've seen in college football or the pros, they don't do. I mean, Tom Brady is emotional. Tom Brady would celebrate. I mean, he is as emotional of a quarterback as you'll see, especially in the triumphant moments. But he never shows up an opponent. People who showed up opponents, Terrell Owens, Johnny Manziel, those types of players are the ones who we have seen that have taunted and embarrassed opponents and flaunted in front of their foe instead of celebrating and showing emotion with class. Terrell Owens never won a championship. Johnny Manziel never won a championship. Tom Brady has won a bunch. Peyton Manning has won a bunch. Neither of those guys, while highly emotional, great leaders, they do it in a way that is respectful of the game and respectful of their opponents. And now Baker Mayfield, and these are two very different things, and I don't mean to equate them, but Baker Mayfield had the video of him drunk in public being arrested earlier this year. And then this video is, or this moment as well, two very different things. But let's face it, Baker now all of a sudden doesn't have a track record as a guy who's going to hold himself with class at all times, who's always thinking about what are the optics of what I am doing, what is the perception going to be of my actions. And he's learning. He's a young kid, and I know I never want to pile onto a young kid. And I'm not saying that Baker's a bad guy. I'm not saying that Baker isn't going to be a great pro. But I am saying that if I'm an Oklahoma fan and I want a guy leading my team at the quarterback position who shows the characteristics of a true leader, Baker has not shown that. And I love that he was emotional. I love that he was excited about the win. I love all of those things. I don't love that he doesn't understand how to plant a flag into turf. Yeah, it doesn't really work like it does on grass. But at the same time, I have my concerns about Baker. And it puts me in the complete minority on this because it seemed like everybody was so upset that Baker was forced to apologize for this on Monday. But at the end of the day, I think that quarterbacks especially, whether it's Oklahoma or anywhere, are held to a different standard. I was disappointed to see that Baker expressed his emotions the way he did. Maybe that makes me an old guy. Maybe that makes me, I don't know. Maybe that makes me just a wet blanket. But I love having fun. I love celebrations in football. I love all of the emotion that goes into the sport. I think we need more of it. But what we don't need more of is taunting. There's a difference between celebrating and taunting and showing up an opponent and doing it without class. And I thought that what Baker did was borderline classless. And it's something that I hope to see him learn from going forward because he's a tremendous player. He's a great guy, but he has made some mistakes. And I hope that he's able to learn from these because that's what you do when you're 22. I'm 27 years old and I still make mistakes. We all do. There's no reason to hold this against him long term, but it is of concern to me. If I'm an Oklahoma fan, what does this say about the leadership of my team? What does it say about Lincoln Riley? Is he going to hold Baker accountable? A new young head coach, how is he going to handle this going forward? Oklahoma may end up running the table. They may end up winning the Big 12, making it to the college football playoff. This may not hold this may not hang over their heads all season long. It almost certainly will not. But it's concerning, and that's all. And it's an unpopular opinion, but it's one that I have. So now we're going to go to Yogi Roth, Pac-12 Network analyst, also host of the Season of Sam podcast. He does work for the Elite 11 as well with Trent Dilfer, part of the nation's most preeminent high school quarterback camp every year. It's where we met. We crossed paths several years ago up at Nike in Oregon at the opening every summer. And he's a great guy. One of the most brilliant minds that I've ever listened to. If you really have a chance to sit down and listen to him and you hear his story, which you will hear in a few minutes, it's just a unique journey, an impressive journey, and one that I think is worth telling. And he has a lot of insight into some of the best quarterbacks in all of college football, even in the NFL today. He's been around everybody. He's been around every marquee athlete who has come through a college football field in the last 5 to 10 years. So an incredible perspective from him, and I hope you guys enjoyed the podcast. Yogi Roth is my guest. Please go rate and review the podcast. If you like the show, give it a 5-star rating, leave a review, tell your friends, and hope that you guys will continue to download the show. So thank you guys for listening. And now very happy to welcome on Yogi Roth, Pac-12 Network analyst, host of many podcasts, Life Without Limits, a podcast you've had going on for a couple seasons now, your new podcast, Season of Sam with Sam Darnold, USC quarterback, off to a great start. We're going to talk about that as well. And gosh, what else do you do? You're part of the Elite 11. That's how we met, through the Elite 11 series every summer, working with the best quarterbacks, best high school football players in the country. Yogi, man, you're a busy guy, so I don't know how I was able to track you down for a podcast right now, but I'm happy that I could.
Oh, come on, man. Anything for you. I always remember when we would talk in the summers up on Nike's campus, and you had a curiosity about you that I thought was really cool. And I think, you know, you wear a lot of hats as well, obviously being a producer as on air, as an analyst, and as a host. And I think that's really important. I try to tell that to the Elite 11 kids. Even when I'm calling games now, each weekend on the Pac-12 Network, I get to every Friday give a talk to the journalism school for the most part. And we talk about storytelling and learning about, yes, the subject, that's important, but it's also important to learn about what it's like to be the camera operator and the producer and the grip, as well as the host or the talent or the interviewee. So props to you, man. You're making this thing 360.
We're trying, man. We're trying. It's been off to a really good start so far. I got a long way to go, but you know, it's awesome to have people like you supporting it and coming on. So I'm excited about the podcast. So for people who, you know, I have a ton of East Coast fans. We're trying to expand over to the West Coast now. And for people who may not be as familiar with you, just tell me your football journey. I mean, from back in college all the way until now. We'll keep it relatively brief, but, you know, just tell me about that journey to how you became where you are now.
Well, I was probably like a lot like you or any of your listeners, wherever they're from. Like, you know, a ball, it saved your life is a dramatic statement, but it gave it direction for me. You know, I grew up in a town of 2,500 people with no stoplights. The only thing that really existed was high school football. And I played hoops. And I played backyard football. I never played organized football until I was 14. But I could always catch. And I always loved the idea that a couple thousand people would come out to a game. I thought that was really cool. So I started to play. Got lucky and played as a freshman in high school. And randomly, I started getting recruiting letters. It was because my coach, it's kind of interesting. My coach, I think he wrote down senior instead of freshman on some questionnaire. So I started getting calls. I'll never forget, Columbia called me and Princeton called me when I was a freshman. And I was like, wow, this is cool that I was starting on varsity, but I didn't know I'd get college calls. And then they were like, oh, we thought you were a junior or senior. We can't even talk to you. But what it did is open my eyes that I could play college football. Fast forward a couple years, and I felt like I had to chase my dream of playing Power Five, big time college football. And not a lot of people agreed with me. Most recruiting coordinators didn't. But a couple of people at the University of Pittsburgh did, and they let me walk on, and I got really lucky and played in my second game, ended up starting a handful of games, got put on scholarship, kind of had that type of, you know, walk on journey that we see now all over YouTube, and was that slot smart receiver. And in the meantime, I got to know a teammate of mine, became my best friend. His name's Brennan Carroll. He was Pete Carroll's son. And when Brennan graduated, because he was older than me, he moved out to LA and started coaching at SC. And I'd come out and visit in spring break, and I got to know Pete. And Pete and I just were kind of kindred spirits a lot as adventurers and seekers of, you know, just things in life. And we started hooping all the time together, got to know each other. And when I finished playing, I played in Australia for a year, and then he offered me a job. And I said, all right, I'll do anything but coach. And he said, sure, no problem. And I said, I want to get my master's, because in my mind, I was like, I'm going to go learn at SC because the program was rolling, and I'd be Herb Street afterwards. And I'm here, I'm 22, thinking you have the world figured out. And I moved out to LA, started working in recruiting. And within 2 weeks, he sat me down on a burrito. I'll never forget, or having a burrito on his couch. He sat me down and he said, do you want to coach? And I said, yeah, screw it, let's roll. And I became the lowest guy on the totem pole on offense. And it was Sark and Kiffin and obviously Pete running the show and a bunch of other talented coaches on that staff. And just kind of worked my way up and ended up moving up to coach the quarterbacks with Sark when he became the coordinator, and just kept moving in that type of career. So that's kind of how I got going.
Wow. So how old were you exactly when you – I mean, were you like 22, 23 when you started coaching at SC?
Yeah, I think I was 23. So I probably moved out here at 22. And I don't think I realized how cool it was. Like, looking back, like, we had such a great era. I was just like, I want to go do good work. And, you know, I always was raised like, you are the people that you learn from. And Pete and I had always clicked really well. Sark and Lane and Mark Jackson, who's now the AD at Villanova, they were kind of like big brothers to me when I was playing in college, because I'd come out, like I referenced, on spring break or in the summer and just kind of hang and work out or whatever. And so I kind of just got to know the guys. And Pete's environment is so different than a lot of big-time Power 5 programs in terms of he makes everybody feel really welcome. You know, it's not like there's this big, you know, cement gate that, like, is super hard to get into. And we just vibed, you know, and we vibe more outside of football. So much, man, that when I was coaching, I was getting my master's too, my first 2 years. So I was sleeping in the office the majority of the year. And Pete would sleep in the office two nights a week, Sundays and Mondays usually. And we would meet pretty much at midnight, Sunday and Monday, and we would talk life. We would talk philosophy. And I always say that Sark and Lane, I give them all the credit in the world for teaching me and giving me a PhD in football. But Pete taught me about the philosophy of organizing a program and leading and cultivating those types of relationships. So now as an analyst, it's so fun because the one question I ask every Friday when I meet with coaches is, what's the philosophy around here? And I ask the head coach, I ask the coordinators, and I ask the student athletes. And I can predict most games, winning or losing, based on the consistency of those answers. And that's something I learned at midnight, you know, in Heritage Hall, you know, 12 years ago.
Wow, that's incredible. So who was the quarterback then when you were there? Was that post-Leinart? Was that the Sanchez? John David Booty? Yes. Who was that?
It was all of them. So my first year was Matt, and that's when we lost to Texas. That was kind of the grunt my first 2 years. And then I actually, when Lane got the Oakland job, I was going there with him and took the job, was all set, went up there. And then out of nowhere, Pete offered me to come back, and Sark was going to be the play caller full time because those guys had split it previously. And he said, you can coach quarterbacks and no longer have to sleep in the office and do all the crazy grunt work that was, you know, required of you, and which is required of everybody who kind of gets going early on in the coaching world or any job for that matter. And I took it and came back. And that was when John David Booty was a senior, and Sanchez, that was the following year. And it was really fun to be around those guys and be able to, you know, signal in plays and, you know, run meetings, or just really be able to take what you learned through osmosis and listening to then speak it just a little bit before I ended up transferring out into the media.
Yeah. Did you feel like, I'm fascinated by this part of the story because I haven't even myself been able to really talk to you in this much depth about it, but did you feel like you were ready for that? And looking back now, I'm sure everybody looks back and they're like, oh, I was never ready for, you're never really ready for that next job. You just kind of take it. But I mean, at that moment, what was going through your head?
Oh yeah, I didn't flinch at all. I mean, I was ready for it, you know, all the time. I mean, it used to always be the thing, like kind of the running joke of like, if you want to, you know, because Pete was so great. His whole thing was, and I love this because a lot of coaches have adopted this, you know, kind of approach, is bring guys in that are young and be the only thing they know. Right. Because a lot of times, think about it, if you bring in an older coach who's been in a couple places, he's going to have his own thoughts and ideals, and he might disagree with you. And then all of a sudden, if you're losing, that might bleed over into the position group. And now it's a disaster. Right. Pete's whole thing was, I'm going to train everybody. So when I lose guys, because we knew SC was a launching pad, we'd call it, to other jobs. I mean, look at Eddie Orgeron, Nick Holt, everybody. I mean, Lane got the Raider job, Sark, UW. Like, it was a launching pad, and everybody probably got jobs prior to them being prepared for them, me included. I mean, I've never really thought about it, but the confidence that you gain, because, you know, he'd let me call plays and scrimmages, and you know, his job was, and he would tell me and tell all of his young assistants, when so-and-so leaves, I need to have the confidence to elevate you. And that's what you were always competing for. You know, you weren't necessarily competing to get any other job. I mean, you know, think about it in coaching. Every coach does this. You get on the whiteboard in the middle of the night, and every coach has this game where you say, write your top five jobs. Pretty much everybody in the world would say SC number one because of the pedigree, private school, it recruits well, you're in Southern California. Like, it's a dream job. So you didn't have to be motivated by anything. You just had to be ready to show up. And when you're in the meetings with these high profile recruits, they were just dudes. And for me, my roommate in college was Larry Fitzgerald and Antonio Bryant. So I was around two Biletnikoff Award winners my whole life.
Right.
So I kind of, you don't even think that way, to be honest with you. You're just, you know, pumped to go teach and be a part of it. And for me, I always felt that, I got the inside scoop with Pete because we were so tight and we'd stay up so late, and I ended up writing his book because of those types of conversations and relationships. So I always say that, you know, my parents were both therapists and they created the clay, but Pete molded it when I got out into my 20s in Los Angeles, where you could clearly get lost in a big city. I owe him my life for that because he saw something in me, I don't know what, and said, all right, I'm going to continue to nurture and cultivate this, as did all the guys on the staff. And my job was just to listen. I still have all my notes in my binders. And then when given the opportunity, just trust that I was trained. And it's kind of like how quarterbacks play now. You just want them to trust their training. And I kind of did the same thing as a coach.
It seems like from the outside that Pete is just a different guy. He's a different breed from even most football coaches that we're used to. And hearing you talk about how much he empowered you as a young coach, and that was his philosophy as a whole running a program, in your experience now just being around these other coaches as a broadcaster, I mean, do you think that are many other coaches like that? Or is Pete really set apart in being able to empower young coaches? And it seems like so many coaches these days, whether it's at the college level or the pros, I mean, they like to have control, right? And you need to be able to delegate to a degree. And I think some of the best coaches in college football do that. But how many coaches do you think truly are able to let loose like Pete was?
You know, Josh, he I would never describe him as a coach. You know, he's a thought leader. You know, I think he's one of the biggest thought leaders of the 21st century. I mean, if you think about, and I get that I'm like a homer to Pete, but if you look at it objectively, let's just look at last year and what happened with Colin Kaepernick in the NFL. What were some of the things he did, right? He brought in people like Bill Russell, right? He brought in, you know, Dr. Harry Edwards. And he continues to do it. I mean, the stuff he's doing there that isn't getting publicized in terms of cultivating conversations around real life issues, right? He did the same thing in LA. When I was here, A Better LA was his nonprofit foundation, and it was rolling. And Tuesday nights, I don't know how many people know this, but Tuesday nights, Pete would leave work at 10:15 and go, with members of the community, go into the inner city of Los Angeles, not to give anybody any advice. He'd say, my job is to just listen. And he would bring me along with him on some of those. And to me, that's where he's different. And that's why players play hard for him, because he's a truth teller. That's why people are obviously, you know, they lean into him. This is the guy, when he was at the Jets, he wrote a movie script his 1 year as head coach, you know, like he always is doing other stuff.
Yeah.
And he would never allow himself to be defined just as a coach. But on that same note, a pet peeve of mine overall in the media is that when it comes to him, whenever I go on a big show where they ask me about him, because they ask about all this fun stuff. So remember, he's a defensive savant, you know, trained by Monty Kiffin, you know, the acclaimed inventor of the Tampa 2 defense. Mm-hmm. You look at what his teams have done at every level defensively, the corners that he's coached. When I see Ronnie Lott and Coach Carroll come up and talk to one another, it's different. I mean, he's always been an expert there first. And I think that gets forgotten because of how well he does all the other stuff, from not only being a head coach, but the nonprofit world, the motivational speaking, blah, blah, blah. But overall, he's a one percenter, you know, and I've been lucky like you in sports. You meet a lot of people that have found success, but no one that I've met is like him creatively, empathetically, energetically. I mean, for a guy in his mid-60s, he's unique, and he's the greatest competitor I've ever been around.
Well, you know, for the first time in almost a decade, USC seems like they're close to being back to what they were when Pete was there. And Sam Darnold, a guy you know very well through that podcast that you guys have started this season, is rolling. He's maybe the favorite to win the Heisman, and there's a long way to go, but he looked the part certainly on Saturday night. And just watching that USC-Stanford game, now fast forwarding to this USC team, what did you see, not just from Sam on Saturday night, but from this USC team as a whole? What do you think that this team's ceiling is?
Yeah, it was an impressive night. I just got done breaking the game down here, you know, when I go on the Pac-12 networks during the week. And when I watch Sam, I think Sam completes more throws than the majority of quarterbacks would even attempt in terms of the specific type of throw. His catalog of throws is unique. His ability to see windows, it's like a basketball player. It's a point guard, right? It's not the assist, but it's the pass that leads to the assist. Clearly, he's got a basketball background, but he sees things happen early. I think his second reaction game is probably as good as anybody in the country. And by that, I mean when something flashes, he can adjust and still get the ball out. He can adjust again, get the ball out. He's unique there, you know, and overall for them as a team, where I was impressed was they were so physical, you know, their front seven, I think Achenna Nwosu, he was my preseason defensive player of the year in the Pac-12. And he showed it against the most physical offensive front he'll probably see all season long. You know, maybe all year long. You could argue any team's offensive line in Stanford's and put them up against one another. They were violent. You know, their offensive line was violent. You know, they called an incredible game, I thought, on third down. They ran the ball a lot, you know, versus majority teams on third and six plus. They're going to throw it. And they have a young receiving core, and Stanford's strength is their secondary and playing bump, press, disrupting their timing in the passing game. And SC just kept feeding the backs. And I think when you look at Clay Helton, their head coach, and what he said from day one is we're going to run the ball. And when you look at the Pac-12, for your East Coast friends, they think QBs. But if you dive in and you look at Pac-10 or Pac-12 champions, over the last X amount of years, definitely the last six, I have to go back and look further. Whoever's won the division has ran the ball almost 10% more than they threw it, right? So for as much of a passing league as it's known for, the teams that win are the ones that can dictate terms. And you dictate terms by running the football and creating play action opportunities for your QBs. And they're impressive, man. I did not think they would dominate like they did physically against Stanford. And I had to turn the film on to see it, to be like, oof, I watched it on TV, but let me watch it one more time. And it was accurate again the second time.
Well, what was the biggest difference between the Western Michigan game and Stanford? Because I think from an outsider's perspective, you see those two games, and clearly they turned it on there late in the game against the Broncos in week one. But I guess now you have to wonder, which USC team are we going to see? They got Texas this week, which, you know, the Longhorns, they are hungry for this win, and then they have Washington State in a couple weeks. I mean, there are some games on the schedule coming up that are challenging if they don't come out and play the way they did, like on Saturday night against Stanford. So what was the difference between those two games, in your opinion, and which USC do you think we'll see? Can they be that consistent team the rest of the season?
Well, I think something always forgotten about, and always remind, it's a big reminder for me in college football, is that they're 18 to 22. Yep. You know, like they're kids, and I can say that now being older. Like, I'm calling a game this weekend where a guy I played with in college, his son's playing wide receiver. You know, like, I'm like, geez, I just got super old. But it's a real reminder that the ebbs and flows of an academic year, the ebbs and flows of trying to, what I call, try hard instead of try easy. Like, you try to do too much, you try to get to the college football playoff week one. The natural element of playing an opponent versus playing yourself, you know, that is going to give you everything in the history that they have, which was Western Michigan, as well as they went up against a pretty physical offensive line that I think has players that would play in Power 5 football up front specifically.
Sure.
I think it's too hard to say we had a tale of two teams after two games. Yeah, I get that's our sample size.
Yeah.
But it's not like Alabama looked like world beaters against Fresno State either. Right. Like, I think you can go across the board and say, you know what, guys, week one, it's kind of hard. You know, you're trying, you know, Stanford looked epic against Rice, but, you know, they should, especially because they dictate terms so much in the run game. But I don't know. I think that's just college football. You know, I think there's just certain realities there that Washington last year had to go to, I think, overtime at Arizona, a team that won three games. You know, I just think you're going to see those games happen throughout the entire season. So,
oh, absolutely.
What's the difference? I don't know. I mean, you want to say focus, they were more jacked up. Yeah, those things are all realities, I think, when you're dealing with kids that are playing major college football.
Well, and you know, the last thing you touched on, just using Washington as an example last year, and this is what people do in college football every season, is we see those outcomes week one, week two, and we see a team struggle in a game, and we put so much emphasis on it because it was the first or second game. But yet, if that game happens in the middle of October and we already have formed our preconceived notions about these teams, we've already formed our opinions about these teams, I think we tend to give those teams a pass when it comes to evaluating who's going to make the playoff, where we should rank a certain team. But when it's week one and all of a sudden you go, oh my gosh, maybe is USC overrated? If this was week four and USC had had a rough time with Western Michigan, we maybe would have had some concerns, but I don't think they're as glaring or as, you know, overanalyzed, I think, as they might have been in week one. That's kind of how I see it, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, right? Like, Alabama in, I think, week 11, they play Mercer, right? Like the Mercer Bears. Like, what is happening? Like, I think those are just hard discussions. Like the way I do it, at least, like I got a Heisman vote this year, and I take it really seriously. So I put together 10 categories, 0 to 10 grading scale, and my 10th one is called performance on big stages. And I give you a real time grade, which is 1 through 5, like Alabama playing Florida State. In a real time grade, let's just say somebody balled out and there was a huge game, huge stage, give them a 4, right? But the reality of that grade, maybe later in the season, if Florida State turns out to not be as good as people right. thought they were, they'd get a 2. And I look at like Lamar Jackson, Deshaun Watson last year in the Heisman. Well, Lamar goes off against Florida State. They end up not being as talented as we thought, but he probably got a 10 if you're using my scale, versus he probably would have got a 5 for the moment and a 3 for the actual performance on the reality. And that's how I'm really intrigued, and I'm always intrigued on the CFP and the voters of, please don't tell me margin of victory matters. Like, please tell me stage and performance matters, and please tell me you watch the games, because there's a lot of games that we could have watched over the weekend that we would have watched over the weekend. We just saw a score and didn't realize what actually happened, right? Nebraska Oregon's a great example, right? The first, you know, 2-3 drives of the game, it's crazy, crazy, crazy. All of a sudden, 21-0. You know, I mean, do you know the conflicts of, or the constructs of that game, and then what happened later on if you were going to potentially talk about those two teams because they're hot brands right now? And I think it's really important to recognize that as the season goes on, because everybody's going to get a bad one, you know, and not everybody's going to get a Mercer in week 11. Like, I just think it's really an interesting dialogue that needs to happen throughout the season.
I totally agree with that. I mean, you always have to constantly be evaluating teams, and you can't just assume because, like you said, a Florida State or some team we may have thought was really good in week 2, and then by week 7 you find out, okay, well, maybe this team's not as good, or maybe this team's better than we thought. And then you have to constantly be reevaluating those performances. And it's obviously why a lot of people don't like preseason polls and things like that. But it's something that the committee, I think, has done a pretty good job of so far in the first few years. I think there's always room for improvement, but I do think that the committee has been a step in the right direction in terms of objectively evaluating teams without taking too much of our preseason expectations into account. There's always going to be some of that. I think just it's human nature when we have certain expectations for teams, but at the end of the day, if you're waiting until late October, early November before you're ranking these teams, you're at least able to be a little bit more fair when you're judging those teams. So I do think it's helped.
Yeah, it's a great point by you and observation, and I'm really intrigued because I think there's an element to your point of just human nature of historicals, and that bothers me. You know, that bothers me on a lot of levels, specifically in the rankings. You know, I can remember last year, I think Georgia was maybe 2-0 or 3-0, and they played nobody. And there was, I don't know, I'm making it up here, I think it was like Arizona State was 3-0 and beat two teams that were pretty impressive, and one was ranked 12 and one didn't even receive votes. And I'm that's coming from a Pac-12 point of view, but I think there's something to that. And it'll be fun to see how the year shakes out of Ohio State. Let's just go Ohio State, Penn State, Michigan versus Pac-12 champ, right? That's what it was last year. I mean, Washington was fourth in the country, or, you know, fourth in the CFP, right? And I understand the thought behind that of Ohio State's resume, but it'll be fun to hear and see what the committee does this year regarding conference champions, regarding, you know, the West Coast specifically being very top-heavy this year, in my opinion, at least early on in the Pac-12 conference, and how they compare a quality win, for instance, say it's SC or UW in the title, and a quality win over Stanford, and a quality win over Colorado, and a quality win over, let's call it UCLA and Utah, and do they just put aside the other 4 wins that they may have, or do they say, you know what, those are actually going to be part of our evaluation, and we'll clearly be debating that all of November.
Exactly. Yogi, I do want to ask you about a couple other teams in the Pac-12 and players, actually. And Josh Rosen is a guy who's been in the spotlight really before he even got to college. But this summer, he obviously drew a lot of attention to himself with some of the things that he said about academics and football, and we don't have to rehash everything that he said, but you're a guy who, I mean, you were around him when he was a younger kid. I mean, when did you first meet Josh, and I mean, what are your impressions of him as a person? Because I talked to Bruce Feldman several weeks ago about this on this podcast, and Bruce obviously wrote the book that very much wrote the book on Rosen in a way, and he had some interesting things to say just about, you know, how honest he is. And I just curious your impressions of him, your impressions of what he has said in the media, and what makes him tick.
Yeah, I mean, I know the book. Bruce was with us at Elite 11 that whole year when he wrote the QB, and I've known Josh since he was about 16, and I called his game over the weekend. I'm a huge fan of Josh. I mean, if we're going to be a truth teller about him, like he's never been arrested, right? He's never committed, you know, or even been charged with anything, right? Like in this world of athletics where we got gnarly things happening, right? Whether people are allegedly accused or convicted, he's never done anything. He's pretty much been a stand-up citizen outside of having an opinion on the welfare of student athletes. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Had an opinion on politics, which we all have, whichever way you want to lean. Mm-hmm. Now, the style in which he's done it regarding being the starting quarterback at UCLA after throwing for 300 X yards in week one of his entire life as a collegiate student athlete, I get all that. But it's an interesting dynamic where college, you know, for you and luckily for me, you know, social media wasn't huge and we weren't in this crazy spotlight. So we got to do what college is meant to do, which is develop as college went on. You know, every move that Josh made, every tweet, every Instagram post, he didn't get to develop. He got to get scrutinized and react and have to defend. And that's not an excuse for him because you have to own what you say and what you do. And he clearly learned that. My point is that I think his time off last year allowed him to reflect on that for a minute and hit pause for the first time in his athletic career, you know, coming back as a dynamic tennis player growing up, being in the spotlight, number one recruit in the country as a sophomore, or one or two, depending upon, you know, he or Ricky Town were the quarterback of that at that stage. And then obviously starting his first game, he never got a chance to really breathe and kind of reflect on what happened in his life. And he did that. And after spending time with him this past offseason at spring ball at UCLA and then Elite 11 and then obviously training camp and calling his games, he's such a young man who's gone on the evolution journey, which we all do in college by the time, you know, we're in our third year. And so I give Josh, I don't give him a pass, but I think there's like a super dramatic point that everybody's trying to make around him. And I think everybody needs to take a breath, be like, look, he hasn't done anything bad outside of have an opinion. Welcome to every NFL locker room when people have an opinion, whether they say it or not is something else, but he's not saying anything that I think is absurd or ridiculous when you look at kind of the lens it's coming from. And he's an awesome young man. I mean, I really think that. And then as a player, he's big time, man. Go watch the film from a week ago. Yeah. He makes every throw look easy. I think he's the most natural passer in the country.
I agree. I totally agree. And I watched a majority of the second half of the A&M game. I didn't see a ton of the first half just because I was flipping between the Virginia Tech game as well. But, I mean, God, you look at some of the plays he makes. It's just and Darnold's the same way in a lot of instances. But they're just NFL plays. I mean, they're just pro throws. And you can't say that about, I mean, some quarterbacks, they have the mechanics and they're technically sound, but then you just see the plays that Rosen makes, the ball placement, like you talked about with Darnold, the second reaction and being able to alter plays on the move, whether it's from inside the pocket, outside the pocket, Rosen just makes it look so natural and so effortless. And that's what stands out to me. Stood out to me against Texas A&M. And I mean, it has his whole career when he's been healthy.
Yeah, and I think Sam's style, and it's fun out here because they get debated all the time for obvious reasons. Sam's style is something we haven't seen in college football in a long time. You know, you go back in the history of high school football, Pop Warner, obviously through the Elite 11. I can remember, this was my ninth year at Elite 11. I can remember my second year, 7 years ago, when we went to Texas and I was like, whoa, we're finding passers down here, not just who are also athletes. You know, the blend started back then. You look at some of the athletes that have played, you know, Deshaun Watson, Deshaun Kizer would be two that were notable. Kizer was a three-sport all-state athlete in high school, right? Deshaun was a gifted competitor athlete, obviously, but they were passers. Sam, he's a better passer than both of them because he can contort his body in unique ways and still put it in unique spots. And I think it sometimes gives a knock to Josh because Josh doesn't do that, but Josh does so many special things just as that pure pocket guy. He's subtly more athletic than people give him credit. He's just not Sam athletic. He's a different style of guy. He's a different body type. Mm-hmm. But they're two fascinating guys to, at least for me, I nerd out and build cut-ups on them every week just because they do so many unique things from the pocket. They can manipulate defenses with their eyes. They get the game. They're great competitors. They're voted captain by their teammates. it's really fun to watch. And I think 1988 was the last time that was like that in LA with Rodney Pete and Troy Aikman. So it's a really fun time for all your East Coast friends, the Book of Flight, to come out to the Sunshine and check it out.
There's a lot of good quarterback play. Everyone liked to make the joke that the best quarterbacks in LA were playing on USC and UCLA, but Jared Goff had a great week one. So now maybe Goff has finally taken that throne back for at least a week. But I know there's some Rams fans who probably want to see Rosen or maybe Darnold on their team. Both of those guys are incredibly talented. And, you know, you working with so many elite high school recruits, whether it's quarterbacks or anybody when you're at the opening, and you have a unique perspective to these kids. And here's something that we may disagree on. I'm not sure where you stand, but, you know, I've been around it enough now to see the amount of attention, the amount of fame in a way that a lot of these kids have, whether it's Josh Rosen or whether it's Elijah Holyfield or any player. I mean, it doesn't have to be the biggest name, just anybody who has, you know, been at that stage, who's been an All-American in high school, who's gone to a Nike camp, an Under Armour All-American game, places like that. I see those kids and I wonder, you know, trying to get inside the minds of them is very interesting to me. And you have that unique perspective, because I know if I was a 16-year-old kid or a 17-year-old kid and I was being told on Twitter or by someone at Nike or by someone at a big shoe company that I was the next big thing and that Odell Beckham was in my shoes 5 years ago or Ndamukong Suh was in my shoes, you know, at one time, it would be really hard for me to process that as an athlete and not think that I had already made it. And I wonder, I mean, statistically speaking, over the last 10 years, I think it was from like 05 to 2015. So, you know, take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. But over 10 years, you know, there were 3,000 kids, 300 a year, ranked in the ESPN top 300 of the recruiting class. And only 25% of them were drafted into the NFL. So even the elite of the elite high school players pay attention too soon. You're around these kids and you're part of the Elite 11. I mean, you're a part of grooming these players. What do you see in these athletes at a young age? I mean, as far as keeping them grounded?
It's a fun topic. I think that the core is that they, I believe, seek the desire to be vulnerable. Like, there's not a lot of safe spaces where they can be that, right? So what do we see sometimes? We see early transfers. We see blow-ups with coaches. We see frustration. We see pressure get to them, right? Yeah. It's all the things that we talk about the NFL of. Within X amount of years, you're broke, you're divorced, you're addicted to something, right? Whatever. I think in the high school world, my analogy, and I can remember standing at the opening, and this is the year you were there, and I'm talking to somebody from a media outlet, and in comes a kid I might screw this up, but in a Ferrari.
Yes.
With a, pulls a Florida State flag out.
Yep.
Sprints to the middle of the field and puts down his flag, and that's his commitment video.
Yep.
Cool. Hip, hilarious, I get it. But what happened there, when I was standing next to this member of the media, I said, what just occurred was that when this kid showed up at the opening, he was on the 20th floor of a high-rise building, and at some point he was going to fall. With this commitment video and all the attention that we're giving him, including us at Elite 11, he's on the 40th floor. So he's going to fall still. It's just way harder now. And I really believe that with this era of recruits is that it's just going to be harder. So what do you have to do? Because that's never going to change. I believe it's the responsibility of us in our tiny role at Elite 11 to start them on the journey where they realize the what football can offer them. They realize the tools that they've utilized in this game can serve them way beyond just playing and snapping or spinning the ball or celebrating after a touchdown. And that's why we call it a holistic movement at Elite 11. And we try to do the athlete 360. That's why we talk about storytelling and learning your voice, because you're in front of a camera so often. It's why we talk about, ending sexual violence on college campuses, because you're the influencer. It's why we talk about high performance psychology with Dr. Michael Gervais, right? It's why we bring in Alexis Jones and talk about her brand protector. It's why we do all of the things that you get to see on the documentary, because you have to get them out of the mode of you're the best guy, because the minute they show up, I mean, it's Tate Martell, right? He's not the starter. He never lost a game in his life, but hasn't played at Ohio State yet.
Right.
That's a reality, and it's not a knock on any of these young players. It's just their truth. So I think it's really on us to make sure we're educating them and helping them and shepherding them along the way, because they're perceived as though they have every answer in the world. And they don't, because they're 16 and they're 17. And I sit in a lot of their press conferences at the opening just to listen to the questions that get asked of them and how they answer it. And I'm just like, man, like, I don't envy being this kid. Right. It's really cool where he's at. But let's make sure we arm them with tools to make sure that when the pressure gets to them, because it will, it has to, it's only natural, how do they know how to diffuse it? And I think that's a college coach's job almost as much as calling the proper play, is getting his guys into the right mindset where they can compete freely instead of making everybody feel as though they're going to achieve the dreams that other people may have set out for them.
Well, Yogi, here's the last thing I'll ask you then, kind of along those lines, is – you know, the Elite 11's been around for a long time, and it seems like every year, whether it's through the Elite 11 or anywhere, we are developing, just across the country, we are developing quarterbacks at a younger age and with more precision and training and knowledge than we ever have before. Every year it gets better and better. But it seems like at the NFL level, I mean, quarterbacks are struggling. There is a handful of quarterbacks who are great, and it seems like you've got about a group of 8 to 10 who are basically in the playoffs every year, and then about half the league to maybe just over half the league, those quarterbacks are interchangeable every year, and you've got guys who come in highly drafted, highly recruited, it's ultra successful at the high school and college level, and it doesn't pan out in the NFL. And I know there's a dozen or more, I mean, a litany of reasons why that happens. But just, I mean, can you put your finger on maybe what are the one or two or three most important things that a quarterback has to be able to do to translate the success he's had at a younger age and the technical training? And I mean, because these guys are coming in just so fundamentally sound, it seems like, in so many places, yet still can't succeed. Can you put your finger on maybe why that's happening?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons to explore. I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly because I haven't been in the meeting rooms. I think it's really easy, which people have done, to take shots at college coaches and the offenses that they're running. Mm-hmm. Now, these kids aren't learning the game. Well, my response is a coach's job to me is to learn your learner, right? So the reality is that the next wave of quarterbacks has started to enter the NFL, and the final wave of quarterbacks that are there have a couple more years, right? That's Ben, Tom Brady, Eli, Drew Brees, right? These guys aren't going to – Alex Smith, you even put it. Like, there's the guys that are on their way out. There's the guys that have been there for 5 to 7 years. And then there's Marcus, Jameis, Deshaun. You could talk about Patrick Mahomes. I mean, there's a bunch of young guys that are going to be the future of this game. And the way they're – and you look, Josh, Sam – Luke Falk, I mean, Jake Browning, we could talk about quarterbacks around the country, Lamar Jackson, whatever. They're the guys that are playing in college. So it's not like you can go draft guys from Europe or in another league. I mean, this is the reality of what's happening. And I think the truth is that defenses are really good in the NFL. I think that it's so fast. I think that in college we see an outside linebacker screw up his hook to curl drop multiple times in a game by half a yard, and in college you make a completion behind his ear hole. In the NFL, they don't mess that up because they have so much time. So I think the development, you referenced Jared earlier, I think it's just going to take some time for guys to adjust to. Well, number one, I mean, think about it. We did it at Elite 11. We had a quarterback, Tanner McKee. I'm pretty sure this was his story. He gets in the huddle, calls a play, and we all looked at ourselves and we said, that's the first play he's called his entire life, because he had been running spread, up tempo, get the signal from the sideline. Yeah. So think about that. Like, most colleges, not most colleges, there's a lot of colleges these kids are going to where you don't have to do that either. So now it's the first time you ever call a play is going to be in the NFL. I mean, I talked to guys in the league that said, we would never draft a quarterback. We'd rather take a guy like Brett Hundley, who spent 3 to 5 years learning a system, went through those growing pains with somebody else, and then we get him as a free agent. And I think that might be kind of a theme that maybe we start seeing as that final wave of quarterbacks leaves. Because these guys aren't going anywhere, man. I mean, the reality is you know, the next wave of QBs are playing in college, and then they're playing in college. That's just clearly just evolution at the position. But it's hard to say. Like, and I'm not a fan of blaming college coordinators that they don't teach well enough. No, these are the systems that are working, allowing them to win games, allowing quarterbacks to think quickly. You know, now we're learning, you know, whether it's the Patriots or the Seahawks or other teams, they're running elements of the spread and getting the ball out, and they're changing language because the brain is not into, you know, the scientific mind. If you ever read that article, Google it. It's about how the brain learns in clusters of 7 ±2. Well, now the clusters have gotten even smaller, right? So you can't learn explode to empty right, you know, shift to dual right, Z short, A2 stem, Z snag. Like, right. You just can't do it. Right. You know, you can. It's just going to take more time than saying explode to empty right, dual right, sluggo scene. You know, I just think the vernacular has altered and will continue to alter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the progression-based offenses will, I think, remain what they are. And we'll see. I think the game's going to change, and it's kind of changing before our eyes.
It certainly is. Well, Yogi, I could talk to you forever about this stuff, man, but I'll let you go. We'll get you on again another time to talk a little bit more football, because this is awesome. And I guess before I let you go, man, just tell people a little bit more about the Season of Sam podcast and maybe what's on tap. What's on tap for that show?
It's awesome, man. You're going to love it. Season of Sam podcast is a podcast that I host with Sam Darnold, quarterback at SC. And you get an inside look into how he learns. It's a really fun podcast for me to be a part of. Basically, it's broken down into three segments. The first one is I kind of welcome you in and do an interview with Sam. We'll recap the game. You'll learn something about the team you never knew, about him you ideally hadn't learned yet. And then we'll interview somebody unique where I set it up and Sam does his homework. You know, I'll talk to him. It's Monday night. We do the interviews Tuesday. I'll talk to him tonight. Kind of talk about, all right, how are you going to attack our next interview? What do you want to learn? What are you seeking? He'll kind of explore that. We'll do the interview. And then he says goodbye. And then I interview somebody around the program. So last week was Jake Olson. Obviously, after his incredible performance this week, it'll be Deontay Barnett. And it'll alter every week. So you're going to basically get a bird's eye view, or I guess you'll get the earshot view and listen to how one of the premier quarterbacks in the country learns. And what I love is that Sam's really vulnerable in it. And he's asking guys like Trent Dilfer, when you need to get on a guy, how did you do it? You know, he's taking principles and applying them to his game, to his life, to his academics. And you know, so much is made about academics and athletics, and I get that discussion. But I believe that quarterbacks specifically are the ultimate seekers of coverage, of their position, of learning the offense, but they're also just of overall knowledge. And I think this is cool where we get to, you know, with Tim Tessalone and the athletic department at USC to cultivate a master class for this quarterback and then get to showcase some other elements of their program.
Well, Yogi, man, you have one of the coolest stories of anybody working in football right now, and it's awesome what you do, and it's cool that you've taken this podcast idea with Sam, and you've taken it to another level. You've gone the extra mile, as you always have done, clearly, which is really, really cool. So, yeah, man, I've said you're really, really cool about 100 times. You're probably sick of it by now, but I love what you're doing. So keep it up, man, and let's do this again sometime.
Thanks for having me, man. Anytime.
All right. Thanks to Yogi Roth for joining me today on the podcast. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. If you like the show, please rate it 5 stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Leave a review. Really, really helps me out a lot. And go listen to the podcast Season of Sam. It's a really cool thing that he's doing, and I really admire it, and I hope you guys will enjoy it as well. So thank you guys again for listening. I'll be back again Thursday night, Friday morning with Take the Points. We got Rossi 3 Stacks. We'll have another gambling expert on the show as well to give you guys some picks. And as always, visit the website, CFBCountry.com. Follow me on Twitter at Josh Parcell. Follow the show on Twitter at CFB Country. A lot of great stuff going up every single day. Hope you guys enjoyed this show. We'll see you again on Thursday. Until then, be well. Have a good week.